Greco-Roman Symbolism in the Book of Revelation by Robert C. Newman. Now, this talk is a survey of the symbolic materials in Revelation, which suggests that at least a small part of this is drawn from the Greco-Roman culture of the time, rather than the Old Testament or Jewish culture. Here we'll look at some of these in detail and suggest that God has put these in Revelation to communicate with its early Gentile readers. Revelation makes many allusions to the Old Testament, but doesn't quote from it. United Bible Society's Greek New Testament has no entries for Revelation in its, quote, index of quotations. However, it has 632 entries for Revelation in its index of allusions and verbal parallels. Some of these allusions in the, to the Old Testament are to a specific passage or specific theme. Revelation 1:7, he is coming with the clouds, is an allusion to Daniel 7:13, one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. Revelation 5:6, a lamb looking as if it had been slain, is an allusion to the theme of sacrifice found throughout the Old Testament. Other allusions are more complex than this. The several references to a two-edged sword coming from Jesus' mouth are a combination of Isaiah 49:2, he's made my mouth like a sharpened sword, and Isaiah 11:4, he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. The beast of Revelation 13 is a combination of the four beasts of Daniel 7, if you look at its description in Revelation 13. Besides these many Old Testament allusions, some suggest that Revelation contains allusions to non-biblical works. The UBS Greek New Testament's Index of Allusions and Verbal Parallels has 32 entries for apocryphal and pseudepigraphal Jewish works. Our interest here, however, is with Greco-Roman connections rather than with Jewish ones. As regards Greco-Roman allusions, William Ramsey has found a number of these in the letters to the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. A couple of examples here. The city of Sardis was never taken by storm, but only by stealth at night. Compare that to the comment in Revelation 3:3. Remember therefore what you have received and heard. Obey it and repent, for if you do not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what time I will come to you. That's directed to the church at Sardis in the letters to the seven churches. And Laodicea, another of the seven churches, was plagued with a water supply that was only lukewarm by the time it reached the city. Compare this to Revelation 3:16. So, because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. These particular allusions are not controversial. Evangelicals, however, are more skeptical about alleged allusions to Greco-Roman paganism. There's a great deal of this in R.H. Charles's commentary on the Book of Revelation in the International Critical Commentary Series. Evangelicals more skeptical about these alleged allusions, partly because of biblical teaching against idolatry, and partly to the impression that some commentators give that the author of Revelation was faking a vision, and trying to explain how the author has ransacked this or that work to find this allusion. I suggest, however, that instead of ignoring these Greco-Roman allusions, which I think there are several, as we'll see in a moment, that we give another spin to this data. After all, the Bible doesn't claim that Revelation is just the work of John. The Bible is very explicit that God is the book's ultimate author for the Bible as a whole, and specifically for the book of Revelation in detail, that God has given this to his son, who's communicated by an angel to John, etc. So my suggestion is that God, the book's ultimate author, is communicating to his Greco-Roman readers, original readers, at a time in terms they would understand, since most of them would have been raised in paganism. So, let's have a look. We'll start out with symbols with little or no Old Testament background, and those then presumably which Old Testament allusions aren't going to explain. We suggest several here. The white stone in Revelation 2:17. The deep secrets and mysteries in Revelation 2:24 and Revelation 10:7. The seven hills in Revelation 17:9. The title on her forehead, on the harlot's forehead, in Revelation 17:5. Let's have a look at each of these. The white stone. Jesus promises the overcomer, Revelation 2:17, into the letter to the church at Pergamum. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna, clearly an Old Testament allusion. I will also give him a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to him who receives it. So Jesus promised the overcomer to give him a white stone. Well, what might that mean? Well, various interpreters who have looked into the Greco-Roman background carefully have noted that one activity that involved colored stones in antiquity was jury voting. A jury would hear a particular case, and then they would vote, and they would vote with colored stones. A white stone meant that the juror believed the person, the defendant, was innocent, and a black stone meant that the jury believed, the juror believed that the defendant was guilty. So if we go that way, then the indication here is that Jesus promises the overcomer, you will be declared innocent at the last judgment. Another use is pebbles as admission tickets to a banquet. And basically, if we go in that direction, Jesus is promising the overcomer that I will give you an admission ticket to the messianic banquet. Well, that's the white stone. In Revelation 2:24, there is a reference to the deep secrets of Satan. See how it goes in the NIV here. Now I say to the rest of you in Thyatira, to you who do not hold to her teaching and have not learned Satan's so-called deep secrets, I will not impose any other burden on you. Only hold to what you have until I come. And then in Revelation 10:7, we have this. In the days when the seventh angel is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished, just as he announced to his servants the prophets. Oh, reference to deep secrets of Satan, allusion to the mystery of God. These two phrases bring to mind the mystery religions of the Greco-Roman world, with the attraction of their secret rites and initiations. The traditional religions of the Romans and the Greeks had not vanished away by any means, but had become rather formal, and many Greeks and Romans and others in the Roman Empire were interested in something more vibrant than that, and were attracted by the mystery religions, some of which were Greek, Dionysius and such, some of which were Egyptian, or even further east, Mithraic religion was a mystery religion. These mystery religions were characterized by secret rites and initiations, and were more individualistic than the traditional Greek and Roman religions. These two references bring to mind the mystery religions of the Greco-Roman world with the attractions their secret rites and initiations. And virtually everyone in the Greco-Roman world would have had some acquaintance with these, even those who did not were not directly attracted to them. The lesson I think these two passages suggest for us is that there are evil mysteries and there are good mysteries. And you need to have the right mystery religion, if you like. You need to know the God who really exists and his mysteries. Then we have the allusion to the seven hills in Revelation 17:9. There we're told that the harlot seated on seven hills. Let's see how the passage goes here. John has been seeing this vision of the woman riding the beast, who's the woman is described with a title on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the Mother of Prostitutes, etc. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished, etc. And then verse 9, the angel says to John, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads of the beast she's riding on are seven hills on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings, etc. Well, the harlot seated on the seven hills in Revelation 17:9 would suggest Rome to nearly any reader at John's time, particularly when you find out that the harlot represents a city. Now, here's a map of pre-urban Rome, which shows the seven hills, Palatine Hill in the middle, the Aventine Hill to the southwest of that, the Caelian Hill to the east, Esquiline Hill to the northeast, Viminal Hill to the north-northeast, Quirino Hill to the north, and the Capitoline Hill to the northwest. So the seven hills. This terminology, the seven-hilled city, etc., would have been familiar to people in the Greek and Roman culture from the writings of Horace and Virgil and Martial and Cicero and Propertius. And this provides the reader of Revelation with a hint that the harlot is not only Babylon, but the harlot is in some sense Rome as well. Another example of this symbolism with no real Old Testament background is that in Revelation 17:5, the title on the forehead of the harlot. Verse 3, then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names, had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth for adulteries. This title was written on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. Well, the idea of a name on someone's forehead has a number of occurrences in the book of Revelation. In Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17, the name of the beast is put on the forehead of the beast's followers. In Revelation 14:1, the name of God and of the Lamb is put on the forehead of the followers of God and the Lamb. In Exodus 28, verses 36 through 38, we have some Old Testament background to this. The high priest has a gold plate on his forehead with the name of God inscribed on it. Yet Roman harlots wore a label with their names on their brows, and the title of on the forehead of the harlot here in Revelation is her name, not someone else's, whereas in the ones we saw there, the high priest's label is the name of God, and the label apparently on the forehead of the followers, the beast, is the beast's name, etc. So Revelation here gives its original readers a vivid picture of a harlot, such as they would be familiar with in the streets of their own cities. Well, that's a tour of some of the symbols with virtually no Old Testament background. There are other symbols in Revelation with Old Testament background, but with unique features. For instance, in Revelation 2:10 and 3:11, the reference of crowns being given to the overcomers. Or in Revelation 6, the reference to the four horsemen. Or in Revelation 7, the reference, seventh example, the seven-sealed scroll in Revelation chapter 5. And in Revelation 1:4, 1:8, 4:8, 11:17, and 16:5, the reference to the one who is and was and who is to come. And this reference to the seven stars in Revelation 1:16 and 1:20. Crowns to the overcomers, the passages look like this in 2:10, a letter to the church at Smyrna. Jesus says, be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life, the crown of life promised to the one who overcomes. Revelation 3:11, Jesus says, I'm coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. Crowns, of course, are mentioned frequently in the Old Testament, but the figure here seems to be that of a crown as a reward. And that is something that we perhaps translate more regularly into English as a wreath or something of that sort, because they look a little bit like a Christmas wreath. But this kind of a crown of leaves, was common for victors in the Greco-Roman world, both victors in military situations. Roman general returning to Rome who is granted this triumph, this parade in Rome, would have a wreath on his head, or a wreath held above his head by someone riding in the chariot behind him, a military victory. And also athletic victory, the various major athletic events in the Greco-Roman world, chief of which was the Olympic one, were characterized by a wreath of laurels for the Olympic one, and other ones a wreath of a pine or something of that sort. So, a picture of the crowns, if you like. The picture of the four horsemen in Revelation chapter 6. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals, and I heard the voice of one of the four living creatures saying a voice like thunder, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. Another example of the conqueror's crown. And then the second living creature cries out, and another horse comes out, a fiery red one, the rider given the power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. Third living creature says, "Come," and before me is a black horse, its rider holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages, three quarts of barley for a day's wages." Then the Lamb opened the fourth seal, heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come." There before me was a pale horse, even perhaps a greenish horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind it, given power for a fourth earth to kill by the sword, etc. These horses and riders in Revelation 6 have a background in Zechariah 1, where there are a number of horses of different colors, and in Zechariah 1, and in Zechariah 6, where there's some chariots drawn by horses of different colors. Yet the figures in Revelation 6 are allegorical in a way that those in Zechariah are not. This fits the Greco-Roman penchant for allegory seen in their artwork and their coinage. The tendency to represent cities by women, often with a crown that look like the top of the city wall on their head, or a river represented by a man laying down, etc., that would be representative of perhaps the river spirit or something of that sort. So this allegorical picture of these horsemen fits this Greco-Roman penchant for allegory. Whatever the first horseman represents, the others are surely, the second horseman is war. Another horse came out, a fiery red one, to ride over, given power to take peace from the earth, etc. And the third one is famine. Rider, black horse, has a pair of scales in its hand, and you're paying a day's wages for barely enough food for one wheat, or maybe three barley for a day, huh? And then the fourth horse is pretty clearly Death. Its rider is named Death. Hades is its companion, etc. That suggests that the first rider is also to be taken as allegorical. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow. He was given a crown. He rode forth as a conqueror bent on conquest. That this first one represents conquest or imperialism or invasion or something of that sort, rather than Christ or Antichrist, as have been suggested by various interpreters. We come then to the seven-sealed scroll, which these represent the first opening seals of. Sealed documents, of course, were standard practice in the ancient Near East, not just that the seal was put on the bottom of them, but they were rolled up and sealed so that people could not tamper with them contents. That was a standard practice in the ancient Near East, so both Jewish and Greco-Roman, to protect legal transactions from fraud. And there was a way of sealing the papyrus, which was standard for documents at New Testament times, and also for sealing clay tablets, which were used back more commonly at the time the Old Testament was written. So in Daniel 12:9, Daniel was told to seal up the vision. It's for the time of the end. And Isaiah 29:11 speaks of sealing a document as well. But the seven seals has no Old Testament background. One might argue it's nothing more than that Revelation has got lots of sevens in it, etc. But it does have a Greco-Roman background. Roman wills and some other Roman legal documents were typically sealed with seven seals. So one might suggest that perhaps the seven-sealed document is intended to be Jesus' will that he is opening. Or perhaps it is the title deed to the planet Earth or something of that sort. There have been some other suggestions made which would work as well also. The triple characterization of God, he who is, who was, and who is to come, is seen in Revelation 1:4, 1:8, 4:8. And then there's a shorter double version in 11:17 and 16:5. This triple characterization of God clearly has roots in God's revelation to Moses in Exodus 3:14, where he says, I am, and the idea that God is the one who is. Yet this triplet is more elaborate than either the Hebrew of Exodus or the Greek translation of Exodus that we find in the Septuagint. Greg Beale notes that a similar threefold formula is found in pagan Greek literature as a title of the gods. This suggests that Revelation may use this phrase to remind its readers who is really the everlasting God, the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not the various pagan gods. Seven stars. The stars in Jesus' hand in Revelation 1:16, describing the glorified Jesus, in his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp double-edged sword, etc. And Revelation 1:20, the seven stars are the angels of the church, seven churches, etc. The stars in Jesus' hand are the seven angels associated with the seven churches. The number seven, as we pointed out before, is a major feature of the structure of Revelation. Yet it's possible there's a reference here to some particular seven stars. For those who are familiar with astronomy and particularly familiar with ancient astronomy, the Pleiades would come to mind. Seven obviously visible stars. You have telescopes are a lot more than that. Or the Great Bear, what we call the Big Dipper, or in England, Charles Wain, is a seven-star constellation. Or in antiquity, the seven planets, we think of the nine planets, or perhaps of eight now that Pluto has been demoted, but in antiquity there were known to be seven planets, but they included the sun and the moon as two of those planets, because the picture of planets was something wandering among the stars. The stars were fixed relative to each other, it appeared, but these things wandered among them, so the moon and the sun, and they didn't think of Earth as a planet, and then Mercury and Venus, and Mars and Jupiter and Saturn were the seven known planets. We don't know for sure whether we get an illusion of that sort or not. We move on to a third category, symbols resembling pagan mythology. Here we suggest two, and we've been doing a running count here, so this is item 10 and item 11. 10, the woman, the child, and the dragon, found in Revelation chapter 12. And the harlot riding the beast, found in Revelation chapter 17. So, let's have a look. This incident of the woman, the child, and the dragon has attracted a good deal of attention. Let me read you the passage here. Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. John says, a great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky, flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1260 days. Since it has attracted a great deal of attention, each item separately can be reproduced from the Old Testament and Jewish sources, but not the whole. A woman representing Israel, or something of that sort, the people of God, the child, messianic hopes, etc., the dragon, picture of Satan in the Old Testament. Each item separately can be reproduced from Old Testament Jewish sources, not the whole. And the reference to the child being snatched up with no reference to the death and resurrection or anything of that sort is certainly a bit unusual as well. The shape of the story is close to two pagan myths from the ancient Near East. The Egyptian myth of Isis, mother, begetting Horus, the child, opposed by the red dragon Typhon, with Horus later killing the dragon. And the Greek myth of Leto, bearing Apollo as one of her children, opposed by the dragon Python, and Apollo later killing it. Here's a statue of Isis with Horus, and here's a Greek vase painting of Typhon, and here's a sketch of Leto with her two children. The boy would be Apollo, and the dragon here, rather snake-looking sort of thing. Well, what should we make of this woman, child, and dragon situation? Well, R.H. Charles, mentioned in his ICC commentary on Revelation, has John Barr only from paganism, as he does for a great number of things. Well, I think he's mistaken on that. I think the spin we suggested of God using elements that the pagans would be familiar with is better. And this is not something I invented. C.S. Lewis, in his Pilgrim's Regress, and in his autobiographical Till We Have novel Till We Have Faces, suggests that God implanted stories among the pagans, which, though distorted and corrupted by them, still testify to God's redemptive purpose. This would also fit Jesus' remark in John 12, 23 and 24. Let me find that for you here. John 12, 23 and 24. I'll start with 20. Now there were some Greeks among those who came up to worship at the feast. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. "Sir," they said, "we'd like to see Jesus." Philip went to tell Andrew. Andrew and Philip in turn told Jesus. Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." Goes on. This would fit Jesus' remark in John 12, when the Greeks came to him, about a grain of wheat dying and rising to produce many seeds. The myth found in a number of the ancient pagan cultures of the dying and rising corn gods and wheat gods, if you like, was rather common. And Lewis suggests that this is something which Jesus alludes to here for the benefit of these Greeks, that what had been a myth was now going to actually be accomplished in history as Jesus would die and rise to bring life to the world. This characterization of the significance of the woman, the child, and the dragon would also fit recent suggestions by some missiologists regarding redemptive analogies. Probably the best known of these are in Don Richardson's book, Eternity in Their Hearts, where he explains how redemptive analogies have been found with some of the tribal groups in Irian Jaya and such in the Southeast Asian islands. A somewhat similar approach is taken by Ernest L. Martin in his book The Star That Astonished the World, suggesting that in the connection with the Magi, that God, in a sense, is speaking to them in their own language, the language of astrology, to draw them to Jesus. I follow on that idea in my PowerPoint talk, The Star of Bethlehem. What was it? You might have a look at for your edification. Well, that's the first of these two. The second one is the harlot riding the beast in Revelation chapter 17. In Revelation chapter 17, John sees a vision of the harlot Babylon riding the beast of Revelation chapter 13, the beast with the seven heads and ten horns and such. One of the seven angels, 17:1, who had the seven bowls, came and said to me, "Come, I'll show you the punishment of the great harlot who sits upon many waters. With her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls, had a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things, filth for adulteries, etc." Here's Clarence Larkin's a drawing of that ecclesiastical Babylon mystery, Babylon the Great, Revelation 17:1-18. Again, both components have Old Testament background, but not the combination. The beast with the seven heads and ten horns, we suggested, is a combination of the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7. And the harlot imagery has Old Testament symbolic background along two lines. Israel's harlot, found in Isaiah 1:21, Jeremiah 2:20, Ezekiel 16, and the pagan city is harlot, seen in reference to Tyre in Isaiah 23:17, and in reference to Nineveh in Nahum 3:4. However, the riding motif does not occur in the Old Testament, and some have suggested that this is a picture of last apostate religion. Some have made it the Catholic Church or the Ecumenical Church or something of that sort, riding on, controlling the beast, which represents the Antichrist Empire, if you like. But in Greco-Roman mythology, there's a striking parallel to the harlot riding the beast in the Europa myth. According to our ancient sources, Apollodorus and Ovid, Zeus, chief god of the Greeks, sees Europa, the daughter of a Phoenician king, playing with her friends at the seashore, and he is overcome with passion for her. He disguises himself as a bull and allows himself to be petted and such, and gets Europa to climb on his back. And then he heads out to sea and takes her over the Mediterranean to Crete and has sex with her and has children by her. Clearly here, the rider was not in control of the mount, which raises some question of whether one should read that into the Revelation 17 passage. This is a picture of Zeus in Europa by one of the Italian artists, Antonio Caracciolo. For believers seeking to correlate Revelation with current events, it's intriguing to note that the Europa symbol has recently been used to represent the European Union. Europa, huh? A stamp from the United Kingdom, a Time article with several drawings in it, a cover of the German equivalent to Time, Der Spiegel, the mirror, and the 2 euro coin. Perhaps we are to read the harlot picture as alluding to Europe as well as to Babylon and Rome. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. Anyway, here is the Der Spiegel cover, using the bull to represent the Europa myth, obviously, and yet the girl, perhaps she's dressed in a bathing suit. I suppose that's what the girl Europa was doing when Zeus runs off with her, but she is carrying the EU flag, the European Union flag. Here, more directly drawn from the ancient Greco-Roman thing, is this picture on the two euro coin of the bull with the girl Europa riding on it, and written in Greek. This is a Greek version of the coin. Around to her left is Europe, huh? Europa. And here is a 16 pence stamp from UK, England, with second election European Parliament on the bottom, and bull, a dolphin under the bull, perhaps representing that the bull is swimming, and Europa riding on the bull, and a little Cupid or something along beside her there. Well, can we draw some conclusions from this rather quick tour? In our quick tour of Revelation, we found a number of allusions to Greco-Roman symbols, more than 10. I suspect a real inhabitant of the ancient Greco-Roman culture could have found even more. Most of the pictorial elements chosen to make Revelation vivid to its original readers come from Scripture, which is not surprising since the readers are professing Christians. Yet a significant number are from their background Gentile culture, and I did not by any means exhaust those. And some of these are even from pagan mythology. It's true that Revelation doesn't tell us it's getting these pictures from the culture, but then it doesn't tell us it's getting the others from the Old Testament. That's something that we know because most of us are familiar with the Old Testament. Only the person who's familiar with the material will typically recognize the allusions, and that would be Christians who are familiar with the Old Testament. Early Christians from a Gentile background who would have been familiar with their own background at the time, and then scholars in some recent centuries who had studied such things and are familiar with them. Regarding this question of contextualizing the gospel, which has excited some interest in the last generation or so, the example of Revelation needs to be factored into our thinking because it looks here as if God has contextualized the gospel to help, in this sense, Greco-Romans of a pagan background to understand some of what is going on. That's some of what's been suggested by Don Richardson and others in connection with the missionary work in various countries, looking for features that are already in the culture that would suggest gospel parallels, pictures of the gospel, if you'd like. This should also cause us to consider, what sort of presence did God maintain among the Gentiles during those centuries when he concentrated on Israel? We have a few little insights in it. In the Old Testament, people like Enoch and Melchizedek and such. So what sort of presence did God maintain then? And what sort of presence is he maintaining even now? We have stories come back to us of Muslims receiving visions of Jesus, etc. And to what extent is that sort of thing going on as well? To what sort of extent is Lewis's idea of God sending pictures to the pagans something that we should be thinking about, I think? Well, for some further reading, I would suggest a more detailed treatment of this topic is given in my paper, Greco-Roman Symbolism in the Book of Revelation, which I prepared for a meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society. And that paper is available from the Theological Research Exchange Network at www.tren.com. Well, that's the end of our talk. I hope it has been helpful to you in thinking through some of these things.